From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, the fall elections and the holiday season lead to a double whammy for the state's suicide helpline. At least the Packers are winning again.
Later, Pewaukee High School puts its own stamp on the Shark Tank concept, a capstone class called Insight.
Project-based learning is starting to be an initiative that the district is starting to push. And I think part of that is because of the success of our students in Insight.
Artist Della Wells talks about the inspiration behind her pillow doll creations.
Mostly it's how I feel, but sometimes if somebody pisses me off or they influence me, I may do a piece of artwork about them. I may do a doll about them.
And an essayist reflects on what it really means to come home for Christmas. Lake Effect is next, but first the news.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. For some, the fall has been a trying time for their mental health. Some are overwhelmed by political news. Others may be along the roller coaster season of the Green Bay Packers. Add to that the upcoming holidays, and it is a season that keeps staffers at the statewide Center for Suicide Awareness busy.
The nonprofit center is based in Kaukauna and offers text-based emotional support. Barb Begalke is the organization's executive director, and she joins us in the studio. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Mitch. It's great to be here.
So anecdotally, we always seem to hear that the holiday season is a stressful time for many people. Do you see that reflected in the work that you do?
Absolutely. You know, the holidays are a day of family and rejoicing and getting together. And so you see a lot of people, you know, hustling and bustling and being happy. And so if you're sitting there sort of going, but I'm not happy, you sort of really feel alone. And with the holidays, too, you also feel stressed. You sit there and say, you know, how many more days until the holidays? How many more days before I have my shopping done? We love our families, but sometimes families can also cause stress.
I hear that, yes.
Right? Exactly. And so with that being said, we see that on our text line, the Hope Line, a lot of times people will just say, you know, I'm feeling overwhelmed. Looking forward to the holidays, but I'm feeling pressure. And so those are the kind of things we look out for, the holiday blues, we call them.
Do expectations play into that as well? I mean, you're supposed to be happy this time of year.
Right. And so what happens if you're not? You don't fit in. And I think all the expectations of, if I'm going over and I'm cooking the meal, well, what if so-and-so doesn't like my sweet potato pie? You know, those kind of expectations we actually put on ourselves, and sometimes we can't rise to those kind of standards.
Well, and so when does stress become overwhelmed, and when does overwhelmed intersect with the work that you do in terms of, you know, raising awareness for suicide and intervening when it becomes a real danger?
Absolutely. You know, we all have stress. That's every day. No matter what age you have stress. Even in the work we do with our small little kiddos in elementary, they have stress as well. And as we grow into adulthood, our stresses differ. And so when we talk about effectively handling our stress, that's saying, yes, every day we might have a good day or a bad day, but we can effectively start a next day with a new attitude, with a positive attitude, or I can get through this type of attitude. When we start to see the next level, what you talked about is overwhelmed, where it starts to be very cumbersome, where people are saying, you know what, I can't sleep at night. Or this is affecting my work relationships, my personal relationships. That's when we start to say you're in the overwhelmed stage.
There's no reset button after that stressful day.
Exactly. And so people will say to us, you know, I can't put it away. I'm laying awake and I can't put my day away. And that's when we think about, you know what, you're not getting enough sleep. We've all been there where we wake up the next day and say, I'm not really feeling refreshed. And so with that, the next level that we really are concerned about is when you have those days that add into weeks and weeks add into months, where you really do see somebody that is now getting into what we call the depression stage, where it's been lasting more than 30 days. It's not just, you know, I had a bad week at work or a bad week just period. It is, I've had 30 days and I am not doing well. And so we really urge, when people get to that point, to reach out to people. I think that's the biggest message when we talk about suicide prevention is reach out. Talk about it. Doing these kind of interviews, breaking that stigma that people think, yeah, but if I reach out, I'm going to look weak, or they're going to think less of me. We got to break those stigmas of saying no. Everybody struggles somewhere down in their life. We all need help.
Well, and there's this image I think that a lot of us have in our heads about the suicide helpline. Mm-hmm. And this is, you know, these are things that have been around for a long time. I'm struck by the fact that it has, if not been replaced, certainly supplanted or added to by people. You have a text helpline.
Correct. You know, technology has changed us. Let's face it, anybody that has a teenager, how do you get a hold of a teenager? You text them. They don't answer their phones, but they'll answer you if you text. So when we really work with suicide prevention, it's saying, how do you get to the person that needs it? And if it's technology, let's use it to our advantage. And so, yes, we have some suicide hotlines that you can call and pick up. But what if you had somebody that could text into it? So a couple things with text. A, you're anonymous. It gives that safety factor. They don't hear the reflection in my voice. They don't really know who I am. Hard of hearing, and people in the deaf community. There is nothing that has to be set up so there's no barrier involved with it. People that don't feel like they're in a safe spot to talk, now they have the ability to text. And so it's just adding another component to get a resource to the people that need it.
Is it more complicated to be on the help side of the equation when you're talking about a text? Because while the person that might be having these suicidal thoughts can't read the inflection in your voice when you're texting back at them, nor can you, as the person who's helping, read the inflection in the voice of the person who's calling for or texting for help.
Actually, it's just the opposite.
Really?
And that was one of our concerns, to be honest with you. We were like, can we feel what this person is actually saying?
Right. Everybody's misunderstood an email because someone is being sarcastic and you didn't realize it.
Right. You know, or they put caps on accidentally, right, and you thought they were yelling. People that are texting in, they know that they're using technology. They know you can't hear my voice. You can't hear if I'm crying or if I'm angry or what my affliction is in my voice. So they're very cognizant of that. So with that, they spell out details that are very much to the point you can actually see the image of what they're talking about. So on the other end, our responders are actually answering these texts via a laptop and a computer. And so one of the beauties of texting is we never interrupt each other. So when somebody's talking, isn't it real easy to say, oh, yeah, I know how you feel. And you interrupted that person. With texting, they have to complete their thought and then that person can respond. And so you get this great connection between the responder and the person that's asking to say, I want to be there for you. I want to hear you. And so a lot of times people say, you know, I'll give you some more detail. So we've had people that maybe have gone through a very hard relationship or a breakup. And so they'll explain everything. I mean, you can actually picture where this breakup happened and how their feelings were and what the surroundings were, because they want to make sure that they are heard and understood.
Who are the people on that end, the people that are helping those who reach out? I don't need names, but,
right,
you know
right,
who are
– responders.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. The people on the other line, we call them our responders, our crisis counselors. They're trained. So they are actually throughout our state of Wisconsin, because the Hope Line is the state of Wisconsin. And they are trained in things like different aspects of like abuse, safety, domestic violence, breakups, emotional support. So they actually go through very tough training, let's put it this way. We have really benefited from our college campuses that a lot of our graduate students, like that are going for graduates maybe in social work or psychology or master's programs or criminal justice, they do their internships on the response portion of it. And they'll be the first to say, this is real life. This is real life when I have somebody going back and forth with me and I really have to understand what their needs are.
There's more at stake than a midterm.
Exactly. Then check the right box on a piece of paper. And so the responders actually go through a long list of education. Just like you would pass an exam, they have to pass an exam to see if they're ready to be on this, because, again, you're dealing with people.
not to sell this show short, but I think the number of, say, 10 to 15-year-olds who are listening in the middle of the day, I hope they're in school, you know. So aside from reaching out to people in venues like this, how are you reaching the kids who might need your help?
For one, let's talk about some statistics for a minute. The second leading cause of death amongst our 13 to 24-year-olds is suicide. And so that's second leading cause of death. Think about what they go through.
They're nationally or Wisconsin? Or,
Wisconsin. Okay. And so they're driving, they're voting, they're going to school, they can go into the military, they can drink legally. So all of those things are happening during that time frame, yet it's the second leading cause of death is suicide. And so when we talk about reaching down to people, we use the mode that works. So the Department of Public Education has said, you know what, we want this text line in every single public, private, you name it, educational type of group. You will see anything from posters in bathroom walls to cards that are in front of you to magnets on file cabinets to
Can cozies.
Believe it or not, to work with our 21 and above age, we teamed up with Miller Beer. And Miller Beer has a pint glass for us that on the other side is a text line. And so the tavern leagues have picked that up and said, boy, what a great way to know that if somebody walks into my tavern or bar to say, hey, you're struggling, you're talking, you know that this is a resource for you. And so our tavern leagues have really picked it up and moved it throughout. Packer games, when the Packers aren't doing good, you see a lot of those text lines sitting out there on the bar.
Really?
Exactly. There's a lot of bars here in Milwaukee, Wisconsin that have our Hopeline mugs.
When someone texts for help, how long does that process usually play out? How does the responder know when the crisis has passed?
Couple things. For one, you're immediately connected. For two, some of the variables that we ask is, how much is this impacting your life? So say somebody texts in that has a horrific breakup. We'll say, how much is this impacting your life? Well, you know, like those little smiley charts that you go into the ER room, right? And you're supposed to figure out your pain category. Same type of thing. We might say to them, this is an 8. This is really overwhelming. This is really hard for me. By the end of that conversation, we want to see that they have managed it down to a 2 or a 3. So we're sort of taking that temperature of saying, are you okay now? Do you have resources? Do you have connections? Do you have people that you can talk to before we're letting go of them? Some of these conversations are around 3 hours.
Is there follow-up afterwards?
A lot of times people will text us back and say, you know what? Last week was really bad. This week I'm doing good. So they actually do their own follow-up. Because the service is free and it's open 24/7, they can text as many times as they want. We'll have people say, this week is really bad. Can I text every day? You bet. It's there for you.
And so to bring this conversation full circle, we're talking about the holidays. Have you seen that stress level reflected in the volume of requests for help?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We can tell you when we see major holidays, like Valentine's Day. Boy, we had a Friday the 13th and a Valentine's Day right in the order. So guess what? Our call volume went up. We just had an election. Our call volume went up 46%. So now we're starting to see the holidays, as well as we're starting to see, you know what, winter's going to be coming in. So how do I pay my bills? Income taxes are going to be coming around. We can see the stress levels already. And the call volume is going up.
The call volume went up 46% around the election.
Yes. That spoke volumes to us.
How does a responder respond when someone is overwhelmed by political news?
That's something that's out of control, right? And I think that's where people start to feel that hopelessness and helplessness is, I can't control that outcome. So that's why I'm even more stressed about it, because I have no play in it. And so that's when you really have to be on your skill level as a responder to say, okay, let's talk this through. Let's take more little bite sizes and then the whole overwhelming. Are you fearful of how this could affect your job? Or is this fearful of how this might affect your community? So you take those and break them apart. Let's face it, when somebody takes on a project that's so huge, it's overwhelming. You can't even sink your teeth into it. But you break it apart into more manageable things, then you can start to work forward. And that's exactly what we did. We were like, okay, let's take one portion of it. What's the first thing that's stressing you out? And go from there. That's why a lot of these conversations last as long as they do.
Well, Barb Bogalke. It's really important work that you do. Thank you so much for doing it and for sharing your story with us.
Absolutely. Thank you for being here.
Barb Bogalke is the executive director of the Center for Suicide Awareness. It's based in Kaukauna, but is a statewide network that offers 24/7 text-based emotional support for people, along with other services related to suicide prevention and awareness. There's a link to more about the group at WUWM.com.
Pewaukee High School puts a distinctive stamp on the popular Shark Tank idea with a capstone class. We'll hear about it when Lake Effect returns on WUWM.
Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio now. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Business casual, handshakes, PowerPoint presentations, pitches, and customer surveys.
You would think you'd just walk into the boardroom in a downtown Milwaukee business. But in fact, you're among a group of upperclassmen from Pewaukee High School.
Pewaukee juniors and seniors have the opportunity to sign up for a capstone class called Insight. The program is basically a real-world equivalent of the television show Shark Tank. Students create, design, and pitch business startups over the course of the semester.
Teacher J.J. Heesch designed Insight because he wanted to give students hands-on experience in a simulated real-world setting. Heesch himself came to teaching after 10 years in the private sector and says he wanted to use that experience to help train students for the modern workforce.
Lake Effect's Rachel Morello visited the Insight classroom and off-site storefront office Pewaukee High rents out to add to students' experience of going to work. J.J. Heesch and a few of his students gave Rachel an overview of the projects they're working on and the aspects of Insight they like best.
My second year teaching, we did a project called The Apprentice in my business management class that followed Donald Trump's TV show. Students were broken up into teams. We brought businesses in. Students did about 2-week projects for the businesses, presented to the business. The business chose a winning team. And then all the losing teams went to the boardroom where successes were discussed and improvements were also discussed. So when I would give feedback to students, even though I had 10 years of private sector experience, I was still viewed as the teacher. When I brought a professional in who gave essentially the same feedback that I did, students really grasped onto that information because he's the professional, he's doing it. And so they really understood it when it came from him or her, and that really elevated their work. And so it was based on that project that we realized we had to do something like that, but on a bigger scale, and that's where Insight came from. We launched Insight last school year, so in that course, they're doing projects for companies, big and small.
What do you want the students to get out of this?
I want them to have the real-world resume-building experiences. So when they leave Insight, they have a LinkedIn profile. On that LinkedIn profile, they have, I worked for a company and did a marketing plan first semester. So they're walking out of high school with more experiences on their resume than probably a sophomore, junior in college has.
What about the students who come in here because it's a class they want to take and not necessarily a path they want to follow once they leave high school? What do you want them to leave with?
Well, I think just the understanding of how sort of the real world works through the experiences that we provide. One of the aspects to Insight that we added as a bonus feature when we were creating Insight is the mentor piece. So every single student in Insight has a mentor that they're paired up with who's a professional working in that career. So we have some students in our business innovation course who want to be, you know, doctors, lawyers, software engineers. So they all have mentors who are working in that career. We have students who want to go into a career that has nothing to do with, you know, your traditional business career. But we personalize that experience for them with the mentor experience.
So they started coming up with a problem or coming up with a challenge and developing a product or a service, I guess. Where do they go from there then? What's the next step in the process?
Yeah, so in the business innovation course, the real world experience is them coming up and launching their own startup. So they all pitched their top three problems that they identified as a class. They voted on the top seven. And then each student started working on the startup that they were interested in. The end result will be they'll pitch their idea to actual investors. So we have some investors in the Milwaukee community who have already said they'll come in and listen to students' pitches. We partnered up with Marquette. They have a program called the Dorm Fund, and it's a group of students who they can only give money to Marquette students, but they're interested in listening to our students' pitches as well. So our students are pitching to their peers, they're pitching to Marquette students, and then they're pitching to actual venture capitalists.
It's like Shark Tank. That's what it makes me think of.
Yeah. Where does that happen in high school?
Have other teachers in your school asked you about either the model as a whole or just like different tactics that you use during class and asked you to help them replicate it for their class?
Well, project-based learning is starting to be an initiative that the district is starting to push. And I think part of that is because of the success of our students in Insight. So teachers are starting to see and recognize what we're doing, bringing in the real-world experiences. They're seeing the success that students are having, and they're coming to us with ideas. Here's how I want to bring a class into Insight. What do you think?
Talk about having this physical space to do this, and they're dressing up when they come in here every day. Talk about how coming from the school building here and having those sorts of rules in place impact what they do while they're here.
When our professionals would come in and do a business meeting with students, they really felt like they were peers rather than high school students. I think there's three reasons for that. I think it's one, the level of expectation that we expect out of our students. You have to apply to get into Insight. You have to interview to get into Insight. You have to provide a teacher recommendation plus a writing sample. The second reason is the expectation is that you dress up when you come to Insight. And thirdly, we have this beautiful building, which we're very lucky to have. And I think the experiences of Insight are just as valuable, whether we have this building or not, but it does raise that level of sort of expectation based on the student's perspective of having this building. You're coming to a professional environment, you're speaking, you're meeting with professionals. So I think for those three reasons that really helps.
So I want to hear from you guys why you wanted to be a part of this. Can anybody get really fired up and just tell me what they love about this class?
This doesn't feel like a class. It almost feels like a business that we come to daily, dressed up as business professionals, and like it doesn't feel like we're going to a class, sitting down and learning about something. It feels like we're interacting, we're collaborating, and like it's not traditional classroom is what I'm trying to say.
How many of you guys are seniors? Almost all of you? Are you starting to think about what major you'll take in college? Mm-hmm. Have any of you changed your mind because of taking this course?
Last year, I didn't even consider business, and then after hearing all the great things about Insight, like I decided to do this program, and now that I'm in this program, I'm thinking like I'm definitely going to go into business just because I don't know if it's the way we're learning it. I'm just really enjoying it, and I would have never even pursued business if it wouldn't have been for this program, so like learning in this environment and learning the stuff we have, I'm definitely going to go into business because of that.
I have always wanted to be an entrepreneur, and I think this class has made me more confident in that decision because all of us have been paired up with a mentor that is currently working in the field of work we're interested in pursuing. So I think that learning from her and discovering more about that field of work has really like made me very confident in my decision to pursue this.
What other sorts of skills do you guys feel like you're learning, even if they're not related to business?
I feel like we learn a lot of social skills. Like we definitely covered how to interact with different kinds of people. We had an exercise where we kind of learned what kind of people our peers are. So like they can be thinkers or organizers or adventurous kinds of like business people. So we're definitely learning like how to interact and be able to communicate with other kinds of people, and even presenting in front of a big group is something that not a lot of people can do. It's something that I think I struggled with for a while, and then like even talking loudly is something that some people struggle with, but it's definitely something we're learning, and I feel like it's really going to help us prepare for college, because you do a lot of that stuff. You communicate with other people and you present in front of your peers, and if you're not able to do that, then that really hinders you when you go forward into the business world.
Are any of you not thinking you'll go into business but think the skills could help you in other ways?
I'm probably going to go into like software development, so a computer science major, and I think a lot of computer science people like don't understand other people, how to communicate with people that don't think like them, and I think like all the social skills here, how to come up with ideas and everything not directly related to computer science is really important, and will like make it easier for me to get a job, whereas someone with just a computer science degree wouldn't be able to.
Was anybody nervous to sign up for this class? Be honest.
I'm going to be completely honest. I was kind of really terrified to even do the interview to get into this class because I wasn't sure what it was about. I wanted to be my senior year. I wanted it to be fun, so I didn't want to do the simple classroom where you learn and take tests type of thing. But now that I'm like in the program and I thought I walked in the first day, I was like, what is this going to be like? But Mr. Heesh has made it like really fun, and I have a bunch of friends in this class, and it's like a totally just like not like easy thing. Like you have to work at it to do good in this class, but it's definitely a perk. It's definitely better than like a regular classroom setting.
When you say you have to work harder, how does it compare to your other classes?
Well, in other classes, you typically learn from one teacher and do like worksheets, take tests, but here Mr. Heesh gives us direction and then we basically like work on it. So a lot of it is on us to do the work, which I like because I'm a self-driven person.
Do you think that any student could take a class like this, or do you think you have to be a self-driven kind of person in order to do something like this? Like, could you learn to be self-driven if you took a class like this?
I don't think you have to be just a self-driven person. If anything, you need to be able to just communicate with other people. Because to me, I don't feel like I'm a self-driven person, but when I'm with other people, I tend to work a lot better. So this class is very, like, collaborative in that sense, which helps me as, like, a person to do the projects that we do. So, like, even if you are, like, kind of a self-driven person, or if you're not and you rely on other people, this is still definitely a class you could take.
You just heard from J.J. Heesh, the Insight Program Director at Pewaukee High School.
You also heard from Pewaukee students Zenkar Kalermath, Brooke Gendy, Emma Styler, Brittany Aiello, Matt Wildman, and Derek Armstrong. They spoke with Lake Effect's Rachel Morello.
Another break now, and then a conversation with Milwaukee artist Della Wells, whose doll creations are on display at the Portrait Society Gallery. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio.
More of Lake Effect now on WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Della Wells was one of two people named by the City of Milwaukee as Artist of the Year in 2016. And all you have to do is look at the scope and range of her body of work to understand why. From large-scale paintings and collages to pillow dolls that would fit in your pocket, the Milwaukee native explores her blackness and her gender through her art.
A collection of her dolls is on display through the 23rd of this month at the Portrait Society Gallery, and Wells herself will give an artist talk about them this Sunday afternoon. Lake Effect's Bonnie North sat down and talked with her and curator Deb Bramer at the show called Alice's Tea Party and Other Musings of a Little Colored Girl.
I decided one day I want to make dolls. I started with the pillow dolls because when I was a little girl, my mother brought me a pillow doll, and I think it was 25 cents, and it was some premium that you got with some cereal.
And so that was the beginning of them.
Yes, yes, because I always loved dolls since I was a little, you know, little girl. And secretly, I played with dolls since I was 14. I asked for a doll every year for Christmas up till 14, but I didn't tell any of my friends.
Because you were too old.
I was too old. And interesting enough, my niece at 8 said that she didn't want any more dolls because, you know, she's too big. She's 14 now. So I thought that was kind of interesting.
I think it's one of those things that we do as girls, and then we think, oh, well, we're too grown up. We're not going to do that anymore. And then when we get older, we go back to it.
Right, right, yeah. Right. And I wanted to, you know, make these characters, because I'm always making up characters in my work anyway.
Yeah, the dolls are so much. I mean, I look at them, and I absolutely see Della. I absolutely see your work, very colorful and very evocative. You know, these dolls, they're looking at things. They have personalities. They, you know, they seem very, very present.
Yeah. Yeah. Some of them are present. Some of them, like some of us, are not present.
Point me out ones that aren't. Is there one that we're looking at that really isn't?
She's not, because she's drinking.
Yeah, she has a bottle attached to her.
And she's, yeah, she's drunk.
A drunk dog.
Yeah, so maybe the baby with the pacifier, she's kind of, she may be present, but she's, you know, staring at you. You know how babies stare at?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, babies and toddlers. Right, right, right. And that doll was kind of influenced. I have two great grandnieces who are twins, and they're 18 months now. And they do look at you with that stare. And babies and small children do have that look.
That thousand-yard stare of the
right, like they can see right through you.
Well, that's they really can. You know that they can. And some of these dolls are pocket size. You know, there's a young woman right here sitting in front of us, a couple of them that literally I could put in my pocket. And then you've got some that are like 3 and 4 feet tall. And so are these dolls representing anyone you know? Do you do that quite that literally, or is it just how you feel when you're making them?
Most is how I feel, but sometimes if somebody pisses me off or they influence me, I may do a piece of artwork about them. I may do a doll about them. There is a doll, this yellow one over here with the daisy.
Mm-hmm.
This one. This is how I imagine one of my great granddaughters looking like when she get get older. And her name's Amora, and that's the name of that doll, Amora.
It'll be interesting to see if she does in 3 or 4 years, how close you were.
Yeah, and I have her carrying a purse because she and her sister Amira are always into my purse and pulling out, you know, they're at that age.
When you do and you're working on the dolls versus your other work, you know, the more paintings, the collages, uh-huh. the things that you do that are more two-dimensional, how do they feed each other for you as an artist?
Well, a lot of times I don't have a set idea. And once I start painting and I start getting, you know, a feel of them, they sort of determine who they are. The characters start to emerge. You know, it's very rare that I'll sit down here and do a doll and say I want it to look like this. I prefer that the doll tell me who she or he is.
How many he's are there? I see mostly she's.
Well, I do mostly women, but for this show I did 10. I haven't done that many male dolls. I may have done a total of 10 totally. And I remember the first one that I did, my great-grandson, maybe about 4 years ago, he was about 4, and he would always hold the doll. But then one day the doll was gone, and he asked me where, you know, he used to call the doll Daddy. And he says, "Where's Daddy?" I said, "I sold Daddy." And then he says, "Daddy's gone." So he was kind of sad that it was gone.
It's great that he wanted to actually play with him.
Yeah, yeah. He liked, you know, he liked holding Daddy. And the first one I did was a jazz player.
Yeah, and there's a gentleman, a very dapper gentleman, sitting right behind us who's got a kind of a purple and fuchsia suit. Yeah. He's right here. Oh, that's Nathaniel.
Yes. That's, I'll read what it says. Yes. Nathaniel Thornton Jones, never give out any loans. Instead, he gives advice, and that is not very nice.
So you write poems for all of these dolls?
Yeah, yeah. Because, you know, basically when I was a little kid, I used to make up stories when I was, you know, a little kid. And I'm really fascinated with fairy tales and myths and cartoons. And as I got older, I realized that a lot of fairy tales, kids, you know, cartoons and stuff for children really are not very nice tales. And you think about Hansel and Gretel, you know, a witch eating them up. So I, you know, want to create work in that vein. You can say, oh, it's so cute. And then sometimes you realize maybe it's not so cute or nice.
Yeah, there's a little something else going on.
Right,
there.
Right.
Yeah.
And they do that to women, too. We get judged, you know, based on how we look. You know, we don't never get, you know, get to see who a person's soul. So it's very, you know, interesting because I'm very interested in, you know, the inner person.
So when people buy them and they have the poems, mm-hmm. and, of course, the dolls themselves, do you hear back from folks saying that this took me somewhere, this made me think about things differently?
Yeah, sometimes I do, you know. And even with a lot of my work, a lot of people said it reminded them of something. And that's partially what I wanted. People know that my mother has, you know, schizophrenia. And she went like 19 years undiagnosed. And it wasn't until I was grown that I realized that a lot of things my mother said wasn't true. And there was other aspects of her life. But I found that with a lot of people, what we think is going on the surface really is not what's going on. So I hope the same thing with my dolls. What you think is on the surface is really not going on.
Well, it's going on the surface, but there's so much more.
Right, yeah. Right. And I think we forget that about people.
So, Deb, before we turn on the microphones, you were saying that one of the things in putting the dolls here is that you have these other photos of African-American dolls from, what, the 19th century, early 20th century?
Right, from 1850 to 1940. And the photos of the dolls come out of a recent catalog for an exhibition in San Diego called Black Dolls, and it's one woman's collection. And I discovered the catalog at the same time that we were working on Della's show, and it just felt like it was this absolutely wonderful way to tap into the whole history of black dolls, handmade dolls, dolls as art forms. So the comparison of the photos on the walls with Della's dolls, it's very strong. You really see a certain kind of resonance. They're all made of fabric. They're all very individualized. They're usually made, you know, as a gift to someone, to one person. They're not being manufactured en masse or anything like that. So, yeah, I was very happy to just bring that discussion, that historic discussion, into the exhibition.
It's so nice to actually see these historical artifacts and how they talk to your current ones.
Yeah, and, you know, like I said, dolls are very important. All the dolls I had was white except for one, and that was given to me by my Aunt Doretha. And that was my first black doll. Her name was Paula May. And actually, my Aunt Doretha looked like a little black doll, too. She was a very beautiful woman. And I didn't know at the time that she gave me the doll that she had to be about 16 years old. But that doll really meant a lot, you know, really meant a lot to me.
Did it register at the time you got it? Like, wait, this one's different.
Be honest with you, it wasn't until I was in my teens that... And I think this has nothing to do with race, but has more to do with, you know, with gender. But in my case, it was gender and race, is how we perceive women are perceived and girls are perceived. And the ideal at the time when I was in high school and junior high was the Miss Clairol and the Beck girl.
Oh, yeah. And
I remember
sweeping hair.
Yeah. Yeah. And I remember one day I was in home ec class. That'd be about 11th or 12th grade. And one of the black girls remarked that, how come, you know, none of the white girls don't look like in the magazine? And then I realized at the time that none of us look like the women in the magazine. They're generally airbrushed, painted over. So we have this, you know, image of, you know, putting paint on our face that basically to cover up who we are, as though we're not good enough.
So as you're sitting in the middle here, in this beautiful space in the Portrait Society, and looking at all of your work, what do you think about when you look at all of these dolls? I mean, this is such an outpouring of you.
Well, I'm hoping they behave. I hope they behave, Deborah.
Do they behave? I bet they have parties when the lights go out.
Yeah, that's why I like to think that they have parties and you have some watching out, trying to control others' behavior. You know, just like we humans are.
Yes, it's like, whoosh, here they come. Here they come.
They've been gathering on that couch at night.
Hanging out.
Yeah.
More and more starting to move toward that couch.
Yeah. Well, they seem comfortable there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, they make great couch sitters.
Yeah. But are you look at this and you think, wow, this is me.
Yeah, and I think the other interesting thing, like my two granddaughters, Amira and Maura, they always, you know, because I had them all around the house. Well, you saw. Mm-hmm. And they would go up and kiss them. They'd go up and hug them. I had to actually keep them from, you know, because they're always grabbing them.
Which is a great thing. I mean, when you think about it, that's what you want them to do.
Right. And I know some kids have had some of the dolls, too, and kids tend to like them, too.
So, Deb, I know this is an exhibition, but can people purchase these?
Oh, yeah, of course.
Yeah, everything's for sale.
Everything's for sale, and they range from $20 to
$600. All right.
Yeah, depending on the size. So there's something for everyone.
For
it's
the
almost more like adopting a doll rather than buying it, I find.
Yeah.
It really is. Like the one that I have... in my bedroom, it's like it's a part of the family almost. I mean, it's odd. It's like I can't imagine not having that doll where it is in my bedroom as a sort of personality. The one that I picked, the one that I claimed, I now have some kind of a relationship to. And it seems like that's the way people respond. They look for the one that's for some reason resonates in personality or style or in something, and then it feels like a relationship actually grows. I've been amazed at how in getting to spend time with these dolls, how kind of slowly the personalities have come out. You know, at first there's so many, it's just like, oh, wow, look at all these amazingly beautiful dolls. But then, you know, now they're starting to speak as individuals almost when I come in this room. And you really see that each one has a very different
affect.
Yeah. You know, facial expression, thought. Like, that one seems jealous. And that one is looking off, into a dreamy distant. And that one's a little mad. And, that one's sizing up the situation. And it's really...
And then there's the one with the bird on her head.
Yes.
I like
her.
Yeah,
she's styling.
She's really styling. I like her a lot. With her VW. She's also got a VW medallion. You must have so much fun doing these.
Yeah, they are fun. And, like I said, I'd be telling like I'm 9 years old. Because if I play like I'm 65, I'd probably do a whole different doll. But I said, I'm going to be like I'm 9.
And make the kind of doll you would have wanted when you were 9.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Is it hard to let them go?
Actually, no. I'm going to tell you why. Because I always feel that they belong to somebody else, not necessarily me. It's like when your children, because eventually they grow up and have to, they have to leave. Mm-hmm. So I accept that they may have to, leave.
And they have a life outside of you.
Life outside. So maybe, they find their new family.
Whether it's in Deb's bedroom or somebody else's wall or chair or whatever.
Right, right.
Yeah. Wouldn't it be great if everyone who has one of your dolls would send you a picture of where they live now?
Oh, that would be cool.
Okay, I'm putting that on the radio now to say, let's do that. And if they how could they get that to you? Should they send it to Deb? How can they get
it? They can send it to Deb, or else they can send it to me on Facebook.
Okay. Because wouldn't it be great to get a collection of, here's where this doll lives now?
It would.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's
How are they displayed?
Where are they living? What are they doing?
Yeah.
How are you interacting with them now that they're part of your family?
And tell me if they're behaving or not. Yeah. If they're not, some of them not sneaking out at night.
Yeah. Well, you know they are. Well, Della and Deb, I want to thank you both so much for taking some time today to talk to me about this. It's been delightful to sit here in the Portrait Society and just be surrounded by all these personalities.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Bonnie.
artist Della Wells and Portrait Society gallery owner Deb Bramer spoke with Bonnie North. Wells' exhibit, Alice's Tea Party and Other Musings of a Little Colored Girl, is on through December 23rd. She'll give an artist talk this Sunday afternoon at 2. There are pictures and more information at WUWM.com.
One last break, and then an essayist looks back and considers what it really means to come home for Christmas. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio.
Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio now. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Mitch Hyde. Are you going home for Christmas this year, or are you at home looking forward to the day that someone else will be coming home for Christmas? Lake Effect essayist Jim Spangler believes there is more to coming home for Christmas than simply bridging some distance.
As we newly minted Marines marched through the Carolina woods in a rare snowstorm those many years ago, our thoughts were not so much of the grueling 4 months of boot camp and infantry training we had almost completed. Rather, it was to stay healthy, graduate, and in less than a week take our first military leave and be home for Christmas. The alternative was to be held hostage in those barren barracks over Christmas and finish training after the holidays. The idea of going home for Christmas had consumed us for weeks. For most, boot camp was the first time away from home. Others, even those of us who had been to college, had never been through anything remotely like Marine basic training. 10 days at home meant home cooking served on real china, not mess hall grub from dented tin platters. Imagine a hot bath in a real bathtub. Home was to be surrounded by a loving family, not 20-mile marches in the rain, obstacle courses, or constant drilling never done to the drill instructor's satisfaction. But we weren't home yet. The fear of failing and its alternative made us all pay close attention as we slowly mastered the implements of 1960s warfare, machine guns and mortars, flamethrowers, hand grenades, and all the other weapons of combat. Now, with the perspective of a half century, it seems ironic that we worked so hard to learn those deadly skills so we could go home to a loving and caring Christmas with our families. Irony isn't the only thing that escapes 20-year-olds. To me and my fellow Marines, the idea of going home was a place, a specific spot of geography. Home was the presence of mom and dad, sisters and brothers, and grandparents. Thanks to a blonde, curly-haired girl of about 5, I was reminded of what going home really meant at last year's Christmas Eve service. She was in the pew in front of me. Her dad was holding her as she raised her battery-operated candle high for the last verse of Franz Gruber's simple masterpiece, Silent Night. The entire world she knew was right there. It was physical. She could reach out and she could touch it. It was mom and dad, brothers and sisters, a home, a Christmas tree, presents, and all the rest. For those of us who know a good many more Christmas seasons lie behind than ahead, going home in that physical sense cannot be. The people and places of our childhood Christmases are mostly all gone. And, as it has been for generations, we seniors are now a part of the holiday experience that our grandchildren will remember and hold dear in their hearts long after we, too, are gone. Our journey to go home for Christmas can only be a journey through our memories, places and times where neither death nor distance can rob us, where holiday traditions never change, where the mystery and magic of those long-ago Christmas mornings can live within us for all of our Christmases yet to come. In that way, in our own Christmas collage of memories, we can join that curly-haired little cherub as, like her, we go home for Christmas.
have snow and mistletoe and presents round the tree.
Essayist Jim Spangler is a retired newspaperman who lives in Brookfield.
Christmas Eve will find me where the love light gleams. I'll be home for Christmas, if only in my dreams.
And before we wrap up, just a production note, we were scheduled to bring you an interview with writer and Milwaukee native Sandy Tolan today about his Milwaukee Magazine article on a local book club that's been around for more than six decades. Alas, his schedule has not aligned with ours, but we still hope to bring you that interview in the days to come.
And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Mitch Teich.
Thanks so much for tuning in today, and I hope you can be with us again tomorrow and each weekday morning at 10 for Like Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
Stay tuned. Fresh Air comes your way next. It's 11 o'clock.